It has most of the concessions. It has, you know, the best lands. It gets the licenses for, you know, the juicy part of the economy, if you like, the expensive stones, the gems, and the rest, timber, mining, consumables. They control the commanding heights. So really, that transition from an economic point of view wasn't altogether very significant.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much for that. Right now, we're going to take a look at our next item up here, which is going to be our second report. It focuses on the garment sector, while the U.S. President Joe Biden reintroduced sanctions to the Myanmarese generals due to the coup that took place, threatening this young democracy.
Following the coup by Myanmar's junta, the U.S. President Joe Biden reimposed sanctions on military juntas, which were formally removed back in 2016.
We will identify at first round of targets this week, and we're also going to impose strong exports controls. We're freezing U.S. assets that benefit the Burmese government while maintaining our support for health care, civil society groups, and other areas that benefit the people of Burma directly.
Now, the military, the generals have often said that they are impervious to international pressure. It just doesn't matter what the international community does, it's going to do whatever it wants to do. And of course, they're used to not being held accountable by anybody. So this is, rough seas for them, if I can use the word.
Moreover, the European Union is considering an economic embargo. If both come into effect, it can put the country's rag trade industry and its 700,000 workers at serious risk. The garment sector has boomed in recent years and has attracted many household brands, such as H&M, Gap, and Adidas. International backlashes against the coup could discourage foreign investors from providing financial resources for Myanmar's companies.
The seizure of power by the Myanmar military earlier this month constitutes a profound setback for the country after a decade of hard-won gains in its democratic transition.
เพราะฉะนั้นเราก็ตัดสินใจว่าเราจะตายที่ไหนก็ได้ซึ่งไม่ใช่ที่นั่นเราก็เลยตัดสินใจมาอยู่ชายแดนไทย
As the more Myanmar democratized, the more engagement the West wanted with Myanmar in economic terms. Because Myanmar has huge economic potential. It is a fast-growing economy. So certainly there is interest from the West to invest and to trade with Myanmar. But it usually came with the process of democratization that we'd like to see taking place in Myanmar.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Khin Zawin. Welcome to you both again. Okay, Khin Zawin, U.S. incentives or intentions in Myanmar. Incentives were given to the Myanmarese government and the democratic process hence began. What intentions do you think the U.S. has in Myanmar?
Well, to that question, I would say it would be patently impossible to do that, to pull Myanmar out of orbit and into the orbit of the United States. What it can do, what's possible and what it really intends to do is have Myanmar reduce its dependence on the Chinese economy, and make it diversify. Many American companies have come in, Coca-Cola, Chevrolet, and all that, but they are under a lot of congressional scrutiny, human rights and all that, and so they are kind of hampered. The previous American ambassador was trying very hard to go to Mandalay, that's in northern Myanmar, very close to China, and try to have American companies set up there or invest there. That is all that the West can do.
Okay, Mahan, you heard our guest there. What do you think the U.S. intentions are in Myanmar? Obviously, economically speaking, that opens the door, and then U.S. can then grab a foothold. Now with the coup happened, I think those things are now in serious doubt. Many companies are pulling out. U.S. intentions in Myanmar, the focus of my question to you here.
Yeah, I think it's more complex than that. I don't think there's going to be a great severance here between Myanmar, the U.S., or the West in general, because the West likes to keep a foothold in Myanmar. They have done so for many years, even during the so-called pre-democracy days, pre-2011, when Aung San Suu Kyi was under house arrest for all those decades. So they've made a lot of noise in the immediate aftermath of the military, you know, taking over politics again. But I don't think that translates to a severance. And I think the Myanmar leadership, be it the former civilian leadership and now the military leadership, and who knows what will take place in the next few years, there may be a fusion between the military and the civilian. They realize that in view of their geopolitical profile and their location and their status as a state, they have to keep the big powers balanced. They have to keep a balance between China and the rest. So yeah, China has huge influence in Myanmar, but I think the Myanmar leadership is smart enough to balance that, mm-hmm. you know, potentially with, you know, with Western influence.
Okay, thank you very much for that. All right, we're now about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up. Stay right where you are. Welcome back to Economic Divide with Nika Batahwaid. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our info news section. First up, we go to Haiti. The political crisis there is heating up. Thousands of Haitians have taken to the streets of Port-au-Prince this past week to demand an end to President Jovenel Moïse's term in office. Now, many Haitians, like the Black Alliance for Peace, believe that there should be an end to the U.S.-backed dictatorship of the current president. The economy in Haiti, as a result of the policies of this president, has declined over 3.1% for the year 2020. Next up, we go to Ecuador. The elections there are reported to have been undermined by foreign and domestic interference, according to an ex-diplomat. Ecuador plunged into political uncertainty because the Ecuadorians do not yet know who will run in a runoff presidential election. Meanwhile, the economy is weakening as it has slid into recession due to the previous administration's mismanagement. And staying with the Americas, Brazil's economy, the largest in Latin America, contracted 4.1% in 2020. That is the biggest drop in more than 30 years. That's mainly due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The fall in GDP exceeded the 3.5% decline seen in the year 2015. And in absolute terms, it was the biggest decline since 1990, when the economy retracted 4.35%. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report of the show, which looks at how, even after the coup, it's business as usual for some of Myanmar's trading partners like China, Hong Kong, and India.
The coup in Myanmar will push the country even further into China's arms as the country's biggest trading partner. Also, Beijing's One Belt, One Road initiative includes rail and deep sea port projects that feature Myanmar prominently. That will provide monetary benefits for the country. However, Myanmar's third largest trading partner, Japan, has acted differently. After the coup, Japanese car giant Suzuki suspended operations at its two Myanmar factories, which produced over 13,000 vehicles in 2019. That is while Suzuki has had operations in Myanmar since the year 1998, when the country was under the junta rule and was constructing a third production plant. Apparently, the only one celebrating the tumultuous financial situation is the military, with huge business interests including jade mining, construction, pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, insurance, tourism, and banking.
The military in Myanmar holds a significant amount of control over the economy. They have huge business interests. In fact, you could legitimately say that they hold a business empire in Myanmar. So the Myanmar generals certainly have, I mean, the military, the generals, they have a lot of interest, economic and business interest in Myanmar.
As we have seen in the past, they cannot build the kind of prosperity and economy and opportunity for their country as an isolated backwater. And that's the direction that they're heading in. That is against the interest of everyone, including themselves.
I'm pleased to welcome back one more time current affairs and impact analyst Mohan Abedin and Khin Za Wen, the director of the Tampa Deepa Institute in Yangon. Gentlemen, welcome back. Okay, final question to you. The coup already affecting the economy, many Western firms scrambling what to do. The UN has said foreign firms should suspend all of their businesses in Myanmar. The coup is going to obviously hurt the people and the economy. The Americans imposing sanctions. Won't U.S. sanctions actually push Myanmar pretty much into the arms of China?
I'll answer that last bit first. That was what happened in the 1990s. You know, when the first wave of sanctions came in, Myanmar just had to, look at China, you know, find reliance, dependency on China, because there was no other way. Now, the West doesn't want that to happen again. And it is quite inescapable. For instance, our economy is dominated still by agriculture, you know, and the agricultural commodities are perishable, and the nearest and the biggest market is China. So it's still there. But on manufacturing, services, other things, well, other countries, you know, and other markets can come in.
Okay, I'd like to thank Khin Za Wen, the director of the Tampa Deepa Institute in Yangon. It was great to have him on the show. So, Mohan, the military junta, based on the coup that has happened, appear to want the power back. Maybe they felt like their political power was waning. Maybe they felt that major industries were now escaping them, or they're losing grip on that. How much influence do you think, in this case, China is going to have on Myanmar to pull it to its sphere? Because we know that the U.S. is on this offensive when it comes to Southeast Asian nations and pulling it out of China's orbit.
Well, on the first part of your question, I do think the economic dimension was important. As I stated earlier, in the early days after 2011, there wasn't such a huge shift economically. You know, the military was able to maintain its monopolies, and I think they still did towards the end, but there were some sections of the government that wanted to push back against the military. I think that may have played a big role in the decision for the military to come to the fore of politics again, which I think is going to be temporary. I don't think you're going to see a situation like in the 80s and 90s and the early noughties where the military stays at the forefront for decades. This is going to be relatively short-lived. On the question of China, look, China is a big player in Myanmar, but Myanmar is also fiercely independent. You know, it doesn't want to become a satellite state for anybody. So, you know, they will keep a balanced approach. And, you know, it's also noteworthy that the Western powers, the US and the UK in particular, so far they've only imposed token sanctions on the Myanmar system. I mean, they haven't really gone out to punish these people, even during the so-called the Rohingya genocide. I mean, I hesitate to mention genocide because I don't know the full facts, but certainly the Rohingya minority were being terribly repressed at a minimum. The West did nothing apart from some, you know, rhetorical condemnations.
Sure.
It's also noteworthy that the previous civilian government led by Aung San Suu Kyi, they also, you know, they were in complete alliance with the military in terms of suppressing that minority. So politics there is more complex than we're led to believe. But I think above all, Myanmar is this very proud, fiercely independent country, you know, and I think the military really has a grip there economically.
Okay.
And they're not going to loosen up anytime soon.
Thank you very much, Mohan Abedin, current affairs and impact analyst. Thank you, as usual.
You're
great
welcome.
To hear your thoughts.
Thank you.
In this in-depth section, we picked up on something that our guest, Mustafa Izzuddin, said. When it comes to how this coup would affect Myanmar vis-a-vis the U.S., the West, and China, an interesting point that came up by him which may indicate why Myanmar may be of interest to the U.S. Our question to him was...
No, I don't see that happening. I don't see Myanmar as being a flashpoint between U.S. and China. So China looks at Myanmar more through the lens of its own national interests and particularly economic interests, and to some extent also strategic interests. Myanmar shares a border with China, and Myanmar is an important country for China because it is also a member of ASEAN.
So that could be of major interest to the U.S. Let's take a look at this border area. There, on the northeastern section. That is the border area between Myanmar and China. Given how the U.S. is provoking China and has cited it as the greatest political risk, it would not be surprising that there would be great U.S. military interest in Myanmar. The history check on Myanmar reveals what may not be known to many. Burma, as it was known, was under military rule from the year 1962 to the year 2011. Now, that's over 40 years. Can you just imagine then how most of the businesses were nationalized and under the government control, or under the control of the military junta leaders? Well, it wasn't until the year 1988 when the government permitted modest expansion of the private sector, allowing some foreign investment and receiving much-needed foreign exchange as a result. This sparked the democratic elections in the year 2011, which opened Myanmar's doors to the world, becoming one of the fastest-growing economies in that region. Now, why the army would want to claim fraud in the November elections, that's anybody's guess. Did they feel that they needed to get back control of some of the businesses that had begun to flourish over the past years? Or did they anticipate the backlash, which so far has resulted in over 50 deaths? Well, as it stands, foreign investment and companies need to make a hard decision as to whether they will stay in this country or just pack up and count the losses. Certainly China is not going to mind Myanmar getting close to it, while pushing back against the U.S. was imposed sanctions on its leaders. That's about all the time we have in this episode. On behalf of myself, Kavit Halfway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Nowruz, the Iranians and Persian-speaking people's New Year, is a few steps away. Today I've come to the bazaar in order to buy the stuff needed for Nowruz. We in Iran hold detailed ceremonies on Nowruz, so stay with me to know more about these ceremonies. Setting haftin cloth is one of the most famous customs of Nowruz. Hours prior to the arrival of the new year, a cloth is spread on a table or on the floor with seven symbolic items, which in Farsi language start with the Farsi letter Sin, equivalent to English letter S. These elements include sieb or apple, senjed or oyster, somag or sumac, sir or garlic, serke or vinegar, sabze, usually wheat grass grown in a dish, seke or coin, samanu or sweet food made from wheat germ, and sombol or hyacinth. Though some put sa'at or clock and sangak, a kind of Iranian bread, as the items of haftin cloth. Only seven items among these are enough to complete the haftin cloth. Meanwhile, Iranians tend to put other items such as a mirror, candle, the Noble Quran, a bowl of water with an orange floating in it, colored eggs, and traditional sweets and pastries, nuts, and green vegetables. The items vary slightly in different parts of the country. Each of these elements symbolize something meaningful, which include concepts like light, brightness, health, wealth, and bliss. I am now in the bazaar. How crowded it is. Oh, look at there. It's Haji Firuz. Haji Firuz is a popular character who oversees the New Year's festivities by singing cheerful songs and playing a tambourine. The echo of Haji Firuz songs in Iran's streets and alleys heralds Nowruz and the new Iranian year. I am now in a herbal store. I'm going to buy some sumac for my haftin cloth. I also have to buy some wadru for my grandma. Burning the seeds of wadru is one of the customs of Iranians, which is believed to fend off diseases and brings about health. Oh, amazing! Someone is burning the wadru out of the store. What a pleasant scent. And I am now in a samanu making store. Samanu is a type of food which is made by wheat germ. It's sweet and very delicious. At the time of Nowruz, Iranian families make samanu all together or along with relatives or even with their neighbors. Making samanu is quite hard and time-taking. Therefore, I prefer to buy it ready-made. Succeeded in buying the items of Hafsin Klud. Garlic, vinegar, sabanu, sumac, and the hyacinth. Oh, well, I have grown the sabze myself since last week, and I have some coins. Now my half scene is complete.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The United States set to build a new nuclear missile, dubbed Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, GBSD, under a program for modernizing its nuclear stockpile. The $100 billion missile is expected to replace nuclear missiles, which have been operational since the 1960s. The new nuclear weapon under development would be able to travel nearly 10,000 kilometers, carrying a warhead more than 20 times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The U.S. Air Force is reportedly planning to order 600 of them. According to the U.S. Congressional Budget Office report, over the next decade, Washington will spend some $500 billion on its nuclear forces, which will translate into a whopping $1.5 to $2 trillion expenditure over the next 30 years.
There's no clear reason as to why the U.S. needs this hugely expensive modernization program, except that it has a lot of support in Congress, and the military-industrial complex always wants it. The U.S. Military machine is kind of a self-propelling mechanism. It just keeps, going on, getting bigger and bigger and spending more money, no one seems to know how to control it, even if they really want to control it.
Washington began its nuclear weapons modernization program under former U.S. President Barack Obama. His successor, former President Donald Trump, who made every effort to reverse Obama's legacy, embraced his stance on nuclear weapons. Trump doubled the number of America's low-yield nuclear weapons. In February 2020, the Pentagon said a new low-yield warhead was deployed on the USS Tennessee submarine patrolling in the Atlantic Ocean to deter, quote, potential adversaries like Russia. The United States withdrew from the Cold War era Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty in April 2019, accusing Russia of violating the deal, something that Kremlin has denied. The INF Treaty, reached with the Soviet Union in 1987, banned land-based missiles with a range of between 500 to 5,500 kilometers. With the treaty out of the way, the U.S. tested new missiles and made plans to renew its nuclear weapons tests. The U.S. shares the unaccountability with its closest allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel, whose nuclear programs have been repeatedly slammed as non-transparent. Israel, the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, has tightly withheld information about its nuclear weapons program. It's estimated to be keeping some 100 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Turning a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, the regime has so far refused, with the U.S. invariable support, to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, that is aimed at preventing the spread of nuclear weapons. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia, which is a member of the NPT, has so far declined requests from International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect its nuclear sites. Despite this, the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, said in September last year that he believed Riyadh is after a peaceful nuclear program. But the approach toward other countries, including Iran, has been different. The U.S. withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal with Tehran, dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, despite the IAEA's several reports from inspections that showed that Iran had been in full compliance with international accord.
The whole bargain that was the basis for the nuclear non-proliferation treaty was that the existing nuclear powers would wind down their nuclear arsenals in return for other countries not creating nuclear weapons of their own. And so the U.S. Has adhered to neither of those principles. Both legs of that policy are being violated constantly. And U.S. Nuclear policy is in disarray, just as U.S. foreign policy in general is in disarray.
U.S. President Joe Biden is yet to take measures that would show his administration is willing to put an end to the double standard that is threatening the security of not only the region, but the whole world.
The United States' close ties with some of the regimes in West Asia, especially its support for oil-rich Persian Gulf Arab rulers, have long been blamed for many of the problems in this part of the world. A case in point is Saudi Arabia, which is controlled by an autocratic regime with a notorious human rights record. It never gets even a slap on the wrist for its violations of human rights inside the kingdom and its destabilizing actions in the region. Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen has created the world's worst humanitarian disaster. Even when Saudi airstrikes hit markets, weddings, schools, or hospitals, killing large numbers of civilians, the war gets little attention on Western news channels and no criticism from the White House. Later this month, it will be the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led offensive against its southern neighbor. The U.S. is definitely a partner in this aggression. For most of the war, the U.S. military provided support, including intelligence and logistics for the Saudis and their Emirati allies. In response to the ongoing Saudi-led bombardment, the Yemenis have been learning to hit back with missile strikes and drone operations. And this is definitely angering the Saudis and their supporters, who have loudly condemned Yemeni retaliatory attacks. Such stances, especially by the United States, have drawn fierce criticism. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed the U.S. for distorting the truth about what is happening in the region. The Ansarullah's capabilities to hit Saudi targets with high precision are improving fast. Ansarullah's arsenal of new weapons, including projectiles and drones, has become a major headache for the Saudis nearly 6 years after they began the war to defeat the popular forces. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution slammed the U.S. and the United Nations on Thursday for condemning the Yemenis whenever they managed to retaliate against Saudi Arabia. The Iranian leader says the U.N. is even acting worse than the U.S., as the world body has failed to criticize Saudi Arabia for pounding Yemen for 6 years. Ayatollah Khamenei also had tough words for the U.S. for failing to act on the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The leader said Washington is turning a blind eye to the gruesome assassination and keeps up its support for the Saudi regime and still claims to be a supporter of human rights. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is widely under fire for deciding not to punish the Saudi leadership despite the recent release of an intelligence report that shows Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the 2018 assassination. The Biden administration has concluded that directly penalizing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would risk damaging American interests. Before taking office, Biden had promised to take a very tough line on the kingdom over its human rights violations. But so far, Biden seems to have done too little to keep that promise.
Virtually nowhere has Biden done anything to change his policies. I don't think that that's going to happen. The fact is that American policy making happens in the corridors of power behind the scenes, and the presidents, essentially, whether they're Democrat or Republican, do as they're told. They do as the money mafia in the background tell them, or the system, the systemic, if you like, backdrop, which is there. And Ayatollah Khamenei has kind of pointed to this, that the system, whether it's the United Nations, whether it's the World Bank, whether it's the American government, whether it's even the likes of WHO, there is an international network of, levers of power, which are used to make sure that all and sundry follow exactly what they're told to do.
In 2015, Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, the U.S., the U.K., France, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The deal limited Iran's atomic program that allowed the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect the country's nuclear facilities more freely. However, despite Iran being fully committed to the deal, the former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the accord back in 2018, reimposing anti-Iran sanctions that have been lifted by the deal. The new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has signaled its willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, yet it has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments under the 2015 deal. However, Tehran says that Washington must take the first step, as it walked away from the deal back in 2018.
Since the U.S. backed out of the deal, it should take the first step. The one that broke the deal must return to it sooner, and knows that Iran is ready to fulfill its commitments.
1 year after Washington's withdrawal from the deal, Tehran began scaling down its nuclear commitments. Tehran says this move is in line with the 2015 nuclear deal and a response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their commitments. A top Iranian security official has ruled out any step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He has said that Iran will resume its JCPOA commitments only if the U.S. removes its unilateral sanctions. The Iranian official said not until the sanctions are lifted will Tehran hold talks with Washington. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, during a speech last month. And during his speech in February, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressures over its nuclear program.
So when the United States says now, under Joe Biden, we want to go back to the JCPOA, but Iran must do this and that. In fact, what happens, what comes after the but is irrelevant, because there should be no ifs, ands, and buts in this entire story. It is, the fact of the matter is that the United States withdrew, they reinstated sanctions, so now if the United States wants to come back to the JCPOA, they have to come back, lift all sanctions, and go back to the way the JCPOA was signed.
Israel is the most worried about a possible revival of the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran and the world powers. It believes that Iran is after its destruction, an accusation that Iran has rejected. After all, it has been Israel who has threatened Iran with military action time and again. For example, just days ago, Israeli jets escorted U.S. B-52 bombers in the region as a signal to Iran. B-52 bombers usually carry nuclear bombs, which makes it very ironic that the U.S. and Israel would send this signal to Iran
who is pursuing a civilian nuclear program. Last week, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, told Fox News that Tel Aviv is updating its plans for striking Iranian nuclear sites and that Israel has identified numerous targets inside of Iran. In response to Gantz's threat, Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Amir Hatami, said that Tehran would raise Tel Aviv and Haifa if Israel committed any mistake.
Any nation that stands in the way of global U.S. hegemony will be subjected to a massive soft war series of attacks, massive propaganda campaign that is used to justify potential military action or at least military threats. And this is something we see now regarding Iran.
Israel has also gone through great lengths to set back Iran's civilian nuclear program, including the assassination of the top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, in November 2020. The Israeli regime has constantly accused Iran of attempting to develop a nuclear arsenal. That is while Tel Aviv is the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. Reportedly, the regime has around 100 to 400 atomic warheads. Recently, it was revealed by The Guardian that even though Israel is expanding the Dimona nuclear facility, the U.S. and its European allies have not shown any concern. Again, even though Israel has threatened Iran militarily. So while the U.S. is pressuring Iran to begin talks without lifting sanctions, Iran has started enriching uranium with a third set of advanced IR-2 centrifuges at its underground plant at Natanz, amongst other advances. Iran has also threatened to stop enforcing Article 36, only if all sanctions are lifted. And it is also said that it will further reduce JCPOA commitments soon if all sanctions are not lifted.
The future of the U.S. military budget hangs in the balance. This as President Joe Biden is following in the footsteps of his predecessor Donald Trump by refusing to cut the 2021 military spending. Officials have reported that Biden is postponing a reset of priorities as part of the Pentagon's expenditure, which is due on May 3rd. The budget will come in at just over $696 billion. That means the national security budgets, including the Department of Energy's outlay, could total more than $735 billion. The figure is comparable to the base funding provided to the Pentagon in 2021. Biden's decision is likely to draw criticism from his own so-called progressive supporters. But a major reduction in the budget is highly unlikely. That's because Democratic majorities in the House and Senate are slim, and not all Democrats agree to cutting military budgets significantly. That's according to Center for Strategic and International Studies paper. On the other hand, Joe Biden, like his predecessor, seems to have caved in to the military and defense contractors. Hence, no drawdown in the number of U.S. bases or troops overseas.
Those of us in the peace movement are very concerned about this because, on the one hand, he talked during his campaign and continues to talk about wanting to end these endless wars. And yet, if he's not going to bring troops out of Iraq or Afghanistan, how's he going to end the wars? We're also concerned about the airstrikes that have been going on because he has continued the policy of Donald Trump, which is not to publish any of the statistics about U.S. airstrikes. So it's not just the troops, it's the bombing that we want to stop.
American arms companies spend millions of dollars every year lobbying politicians and donating to their campaigns. According to figures by OpenSecret.org, top contributors to federal candidates, parties, and outside groups include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon Technologies, and Northrop Grumman, with each contributing more than $5 million. The total contribution makes up to $45 million, which has a direct impact on U.S. war decisions and troop deployments abroad. The USA Today has revealed Washington's so-called war on terror has affected 85 countries in the last 3 years alone. The newspaper also says over 19 years after the September 11 attacks, America is still entangled in conflict in West Asia and beyond, and there is still no end in sight to the unpopular wars.
it seems like no president wants to upset the status quo of the continued war machine. They don't want to go up against the weapons industry. They don't want to go against the hawks in Congress. And they don't want to be responsible for, quote, losing a war. But the U.S. has lost these wars a long time ago. And the only thing we're doing now is expending precious resources and lives in a continued failed effort.
But why does the U.S. insist on continuing these wars in spite of the fact that they have proven to be futile?
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, it's pretty clear that the Taliban control most of the country now. And if the U.S. leaves, because the government that the U.S. has been supporting for almost 20 years is very corrupt and doesn't have a large base of support, and the military that the U.S. has been training for almost 20 years is not capable of fighting the Taliban, the Taliban will have even more power once the U.S. leaves, and no U.S. president wants to be responsible for that. In the case of Iraq, it's quite similar. The U.S. is supporting governments that can't stand up on their own. And so if the U.S. leaves, these governments will probably be overtaken by other groups, and nobody in the White House wants to be responsible for that.
Apart from the suffering the conflict inflicted on target nations, the U.S. itself paid dearly for its wars. America has spent a whopping $7 trillion in taxpayers' money on the wars after the 9/11 attacks of 2001. That's not just about treasure, but blood. The U.S. has lost more than 4,500 soldiers in Iraq since 2003. The number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan as of 2001 stands at nearly 2,500. Those tallies are based on official figures. Some observers say the real death toll might be way higher. But there are no signs that the U.S. will free itself from the vortex it created in the first place anytime soon.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Sometimes making sacrifices is necessary, but what we always need are the things that I already mentioned: tirelessness, hope, and refusal to help the enemy and not to be lazy. We need to reject idleness and inactiveness in our lives. Of course, the Iranian nation fortunately possesses these qualities. To be fair, the Iranian nation did not become tired. Well, you have witnessed an example of this during the astonishing burial ceremony of Shahid Soleimani and also during this year's 22nd of Bahman rally. Despite the existence of health protocols, they enthusiastically used new innovations to prevent the 22nd of Bahman rally from being cancelled. There are also various other events supporting this. The same characteristics were witnessed in the Tabriz uprising, the same fearlessness, hope, and the willingness to enter the arena and make sacrifices.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In the days leading to the 22nd of Bahman, the same qualities existed in Tehran and in many other cities. It was Imam Khomeini who was walking ahead of everyone else. If Imam Khomeini had not been brave, if he had feared and lost hope, if he had become tired and showed laziness, that great event would not have occurred. In the last days leading to the victory of the revolution, Imam watched everything carefully and meticulously, and he was attending to all details until he rejected the martial law curfew and invited the people to pour onto the streets, and the issue was resolved. Secondly, the people showed courage and fearlessness, entered the arena, and showed their presence in the true sense of the word. Whenever this diligence exists, it will be followed by divine guidance. In other words, whenever diligence and self-sacrifice exist, Allah the Exalted will not leave us alone, and those who strive in our cause, we will certainly guide them to our paths. The Holy Quran, chapter 29, verse 69.
Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
around the world with reporters.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair. After hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India. Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress. Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity, and safety of the Rohingya refugees, as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a rarely seen demonstration of unity, the French Solidarity Movement with Palestine showed its support for Olivia Zemmour, one of the pillars of the BDS movement. Olivia will be judged next week for her participation in BDS actions. The official accusation, anti-Semitism, an insult towards a foreign state. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Against Israel.
There is no legal base to condemn me, and therefore I hope that the judges will remain independent from the political powers. By the way, the French state accepts boycott actions against China, Corsica, or against Russia and Iran. They accept that Brigitte Bardot boycotts Canadian products because of mistreating seals. But if we boycott Israel, they say it's discrimination.
The French government is acting against an important resolution of the European Court of Human Rights. This court decided in June last year that BDS is a legal political movement and obliged the French state to pay 100,000 euros to falsely condemned BDS activists. However, the French Justice Minister, Éric Dupond-Moretti, gave instructions to prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products. Since 2005, Olivia Zemmour is one of the main organizers of the BDS campaign in France, with remarkable actions in supermarkets. These kind of actions were considered worldwide as keystones and have been copied in many other countries. Other type of actions were held in official institutions like the French Football Federation to protest against the silence of Europe when Israel jailed, injured or killed footballers in Gaza. A third type of actions were protests